You've heard Judy Muller on our air. She's a Morning Edition commentator and a professor of journalism at the University of Southern California. Judy has written a new book, cryptically titled Emus Loose in Egnar, Big Stories from Small Towns. The book is about the surprising success of tiny weekly newspapers around the country, weeklies that are doing well while their larger daily cousins are collapsing. Judy joins us from member station KOTO in Telluride, Colorado. Welcome.
It's wonderful to be with you.
Could you explain what means emus loose in Egnar?
Egnar is a town in Colorado. They wanted to call it Range, but that was taken, so the early settlers spelled it backward. Yes, this is a police blotter item from several years ago from the Dove Creek Press. Turns out a rancher in the area was raising emus, which are, for those who don't know, very large birds like ostriches. And a lot of his neighbors didn't know he was raising emus, which are good for their meat and their oil. And one night the emus got loose and they were running around other people's pastures. And so this had the effect of, well, people either stopped drinking entirely or they called the sheriff and reported that some strange creature was running through their pasture. And this went on for several weeks running in the sheriff's blotter in the Dove Creek Press. Emus loose.
Your general thesis in the book is that a number of the little weeklies that you look at, in little towns especially, are doing well.
They are doing very well. I thought I would see if they were just surviving, but they are, in fact, thriving. Some 10,000 weekly newspapers covering towns of 30,000 or less are thriving because they were sort of hyper-local before. Hyper-local was cool. That phrase is now the buzzword of mainstream media. They have a captive audience. They have captive advertisers and people willing to pay for the news in that town. And pay for advertising. And as long as that's true, as long as there are refrigerator magnets, I like to say, there will be weekly newspapers because everybody wants to cut out that article on their kid on the high school team and put it on the refrigerator.
My favorite part of the book, I think my favorite stories in the book, are a series of pieces about, I guess I would say, about attitude, about the hard-charging, take-no-prisoners kind of reporting versus the Lake Wobegon style, I live here too. Maybe you should explain that.
Well, since you brought up Lake Wobegon, Garrison Keillor has a fictional character, an editor of the Herald Star newspaper, and his name is, in fact, Herald Star, and his slogan is, hey, I have to live here too. That would be the kind of editor who's, you know, going along to get along, sort of bearing the lead so he doesn't offend. On the other end of that spectrum, you get really brave, crusading kinds of editors who speak the truth to power. And sometimes this results in bullets being fired through the window, newspaper offices being burned down. It's a real tough go when you take on the powers that be. And then there are the curmudgeons who are crusaders with attitude. Bruce Anderson of the Anderson Valley Advertiser in Mendocino County, California, is a curmudgeon in the most honorable sense of the word. Righting wrongs trumps being liked every time for Bruce. And here's something that he told me. He said, things have gone terribly awry, and ordinary people, unrepresented people, and that's most of us, really don't have a weapon, don't have any kind of a voice. A lot of the big newspapers do some great reporting, but out in the outback here, it's pretty rare.
Local people tend to take criticism of local institutions very, very personally. What did you conclude about what people really, really want from a little local paper?
Well, first of all, what they really want is the holy trinity, I call it, of local news, which is high school sports, obituaries, and the police blotter. The police blotter, of course, is where we all turn first to see what's really going on in town, and you have to sort of read between the lines. They're like the haikus of Main Street, USA.
Maybe you should give us an example of a haiku.
Man calls to report wife went missing 15 months ago. Or man calls for help getting overweight dog up the basement stairs.
I know a lot of reporters have a kind of romantic front page view of moving to a little town and running a little paper. Now that you know a lot about it, would you like to try it?
I'm way too old. I told the folks in Norwood, Colorado, where I have a home, and the Norwood Post is there. I said, you know, if I were really young, I would love to take over this paper and combine it with a radio station out here, and it would be so much fun. And then I thought, oh my gosh, that's so much work. It really is a lot of work. You have to be committed. On the other hand, I tell my students, this is a great place to start. I started at a weekly newspaper in New Jersey. It's where I got hooked on journalism. You can go to a wonderful little town, really learn the ropes at that level, and do some good work, and move on from there if you want. Or you may just get hooked and stay.
Judy Miller is a reporter, commentator, journalism professor, and the author of Emus Loose in Egnar, Big Stories from Small Towns. Judy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The stock market doesn't seem to like what it sees in Washington. As the debt ceiling drama drags on, stocks just saw their biggest one-week decline in more than a year. But as NPR's Chris Arnold reports, analysts caution anyone worried about their retirement savings should not panic.
In just a little bit more than a week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has lost nearly 600 points. And things might get worse. In his weekly radio address, President Obama warned lawmakers that if they fail to compromise, the U.S. could lose its longstanding AAA credit rating.
For those who reflexively oppose tax increases on anybody, a lower credit rating could be a tax increase on everybody. We'd all pay higher interest rates on mortgages and car loans and credit cards. That would be inexcusable and entirely self-inflicted by Washington.
Economists' biggest fear is that the U.S. would fail to make payments to investors around the world who hold U.S. treasuries. Analysts warn that that could spark another financial crisis. The stock market could crash, the banking system and the housing market could be in big trouble. But most do not think that that's actually going to happen. David Kotak is the chief economist at Cumberland Advisors.
In the end, I believe the Congress will resolve legislation and there will be no default by the United States. So for me, the actual act of failing to make a payment is unthinkable. I do not believe it will happen, but the political theater raises the risk of an accident. The markets do not know the outcome, and they are scared.
Now, when average investors see stocks start tumbling, often their impulse is to sell stocks. But most top investors say that that's the wrong impulse. They advise buying and holding a responsible portfolio for the long term. And if you're going to sell sometime, they say you want to sell when stocks are up, not after they've just had their biggest one-week decline in a year. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News. U.S. Route 1 was once the preferred highway from Florida to Maine. Much of its traffic and many of the businesses that grew up along the picturesque coastal route waned with the construction of Interstate 95. But I-95 only goes so far. U.S. 1 is still the only way to get to the Florida Keys or the jagged Maine coastline. Quaint local stores and the occasional tourist trap still line those sections of the road. Susan Porter owns Maine Coast Bookshop, a popular mid-coast stop along Route 1. She joins us from her store in Damariscotta, Maine, for the last installment of our series on vacation reading around the country. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
So tell me who visits the Maine coast in the summer.
A lot of people from New York, Washington, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, New England in general, but, you know, a few from all over the world.
And what do they want from their vacation in Maine?
They want lobster. they want to see the ocean and see whales and seals and puffins and travel down the little back roads and see the old New England houses and it's sort of stepping back in time.
So have you noticed anything that was particularly popular this summer, something that you were surprised to find you had to reorder?
Actually, we have had a few things that we were surprised to reorder. Melissa Coleman's new book, This Life is in Your Hands, which is about growing up in Maine on a farm. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it would be as popular as it has been because it's sort of a sad story. And there's one that was a real mystery to us. None of us had read it, but a customer of ours called up from Pennsylvania and said, "Oh, you guys, you have to read this book, The Lotus Eaters. It's fantastic." And taking her advice, we ordered several of them, and we have just sold it like crazy.
Who wrote it?
Tatiana Soli. And it's a story about three photographers during the Vietnam War.
Hmm.
And I haven't read it, but the people who have keep coming into the store and buying copies to give to friends.
So do you have authors come up to talk about their books?
Oh, yeah. We've done that a lot this summer. And I don't know if you're familiar with Linda Greenlaw, but she is on a show on television on the, I think it's the Discovery Channel. She's a sword fisherman.
She fishes for swordfish?
Yes. Her big book came out, you know, The Perfect Storm.
Uh-huh.
And she wrote a book about her role in this. Because
the woman who was a boat captain.
Yeah. This year she came out with her second cookbook that she wrote with her mother. And we had an event at a place called the 1812 Farm. And there were dishes served that were made with recipes from the cookbook. And Linda came and spoke, and we had a huge crowd, and it was very successful.
Susan Porter is the owner of Maine Coast Bookshop in Damariscotta, Maine. She spoke to us from the store. Thank you for sharing your good advice.
Okay, you're welcome.
School is out, and many kids are at summer camp, including camps that focus on a particular subject, such as math or computers. At one Northern California camp, the subject is chemistry. Only here, the students have something else in common beyond an interest in science. They are all blind or visually impaired. From member station KQED, Amy Standen reports that it's also a rare chance for these kids to compare notes on what it's like to be blind in a sighted world.
Mary Church is 17 years old and in tears. She says she's surprised the other campers haven't started calling her crybaby.
I have broken down about school this weekend so many times.
Mary is one of a half dozen students from across California who have come to a camp called Enchanted Hills, about 40 miles north of Napa. The site is owned by Lighthouse for the Blind, a San Francisco nonprofit, and the National Federation of the Blind is one of the sponsors. For Mary, it's one of the very few times in her life that she's ever spent surrounded by other blind people.
They just talk about anything and, like, interests and stuff instead of how I'm just so different and how I'm just so amazing.
Blind students hear a lot about how inspirational they are, but Mary wants something else, the opportunity to learn the same things that other sighted students learn and the tools to make that possible. And that is the point of chemistry camp.
Now that everyone's had a chance to feel those, I want to talk about functional groups.
Hobie Wedler leads the camp. He's a PhD student in chemistry at the University of California, Davis. Hobie says in high school, his teacher told him that because he's blind, chemistry wasn't something he could pursue. Without sight, how would he know when chemical reactions were taking place? But then he realized that a lot of lab experiments can be done through touch or smell.
Each group member take a few whiffs and notice the smell changing.
Seated at one of the tables is a sophomore from Santa Rosa named Jimmy Kong. Jimmy holds a fan behind a test tube so that its fumes drift toward him.
Smells like weak garlic.
Oh. Yeah, it's really, really weak.
Like Mary, Jimmy's also the only visually impaired student at his high school, but it doesn't seem to faze him. He's the kind of blind person who thinks it's funny when he realizes that he's been talking to an empty chair. And academically, he's a bit of an overachiever.
Honest biology, honest English, and honest world history.
Jimmy's probably exactly the kind of kid that lawmakers had in mind back in 1975 when Congress passed the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. IDEA, as the law is known, says that disabled kids should be able to go to the same public schools as other kids. And Jimmy's really at ease in the classroom, even a bit of a ham.
Smash! Smash! Oh, there! Got it.
But mainstreaming hasn't worked out for everyone. For instance, Mary. School is a constant struggle for her. Textbooks aren't available in Braille when she needs them. And when people try to help her, sometimes their efforts end up making her feel even more isolated, like her advanced biology teacher.
He wants to give extra credit to the students who work with me.
What?
Yeah.
It's gotten to the point where Mary isn't sure if she wants to go back to school for her senior year at all.
I just want someone to come down from, like, heaven or something and make the decision for me. Just tell me where I should go next.
This issue of passivity, of giving up, is a very real threat for blind people, a group where unemployment hovers near 70%. And so chemistry camp isn't just about getting a boost in science. It's about learning to pick your battles. Away from the other students, Mary sits next to Jimmy Kong, who's strumming a guitar. He wants to give her some advice.
Not trying to sound like a jerk, you know, but it's just, you just gotta deal with it. I don't really know what to say. It's just hard. I don't know.
She says she knows, but she's learning.
You can't take all of everything people say to heart because sometimes people don't really mean what they say. It's just, unfortunately, it's just the way the world works.
It's a hard lesson for anyone, blind or sighted. Back in the classroom, the students are going through a lesson about how acids and bases interact.
So how many squirts do you think it's going to take her before we're going to smell anything?
Mary's been pretty quiet until now, but she's figured this one out in her head.
Probably 10, I don't know.
10 squirts later, the unmistakable smell of onion.
Oh, I smell it now.
Mary's right.
Yeah, definitely. 10 is the magic number.
Later, home from camp, Mary says she's feeling better about school, more confident. She says she'll definitely make it to graduation. For NPR News, I'm Amy Standen in San Francisco.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.